This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today on the program, a chance for you to ask questions of Joe Courtney, who represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District. He's here with us in studio, and if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. Comment on our website, wnpr.org/where we live. You can always find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Of course, we're going to be talking about the Iran nuclear deal and a lot more that's on his plate. But first of all, Joe Courtney, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, John. It's been a while.
The big news for us this week is you played golf with President Barack Obama?
I did. On Sunday at Andrews Air Force Base, myself and two of my buddies from the House, John Yarmuth from Kentucky and Ed Perlmutter, who actually I room up with in D.C., had a pretty exciting opportunity to spend over 4 hours out on the course with the president.
Wow. So how did this opportunity come about? I mean, what happens? Did you get a call from his people and say, you want to play golf this afternoon, or was this planned for a long time?
It's actually been in the works for a while. Ed, my roommate, has actually spent quite a bit of time campaigning with him out in Colorado, which, in 08 and 12 were swing states. Ed's district is a swing district in a swing state. And Ed's a very persistent guy and has been sort of hounding him to say that, you really need to get out and play with some of the sort of rank and file House members. And the call came about 2 weeks ago from the White House saying the president was inviting us out. And we met him at we teed off at around 11 o'clock, 11:15 on Sunday and finished up about 3:30.
Wow. So the big news for me out of this is I didn't know you were a golfer. I had no idea.
You've done a pretty good job keeping that. Submarines run
yeah,
silent,
exactly.
Run deep. My dad started me young. And, this job is not really the most conducive in terms of, the chunks of time. But, a bunch of us get out and play, sort of dawn patrol at a municipal course down in D.C., Langston, try and squeeze in 9 holes here and there. And when I'm home, there's a couple places that I try to get out with some friends, Twin Hills out in Coventry, Skunk in Talland, and, played Potapog not too long ago. So in any case, I love the game, and it was a great it was a great time. And I'll tell you, this guy who started golf late in life, I think is, the news reports have all talked about. He is clearly got the bug. He just was great company. We had a 2-ball match combined, and I was teamed up with the president with the other two on the other side, and we got some strokes initially. John Yarmuth's a 3,
okay,
from Kentucky, but we actually rolled up a pretty big lead pretty early, and we gave back the strokes on the back 9. As a match, we closed them out.
Yeah.
About 14th or 15th hole, but they pressed, and they won the press. So I had to pay my roommate $3, which I'll never hear the end of.
So it was a $3 bet. So what's your handicap?
I'm about a 12.
You're about a 12. So, yeah. So you're a pretty good golfer. You're a better golfer than the president, probably.
A little bit. I'll tell you, his game is, for someone, again, who started late in life, he plays steady. And, frankly, the people's rounds pretty much matched up to their handicaps. And it was a lot of fun. It was a match that everybody was sort of engaged in to the last putt.
I just have to ask you one more golf question. You're standing over a putt that's maybe worth, $3, but your teammate is the president. I mean, does this put extra pressure on you? I mean, are you stepping up to that thinking, I kind of got to make this putt. The president is my teammate.
I played well. I was very happy, but I will confess in the press on the 18th hole, I left it on the lip, which if I had knocked it in, we would have shut the door on those guys. And so that one I'll never forget.
That one you'll never forget. So moving on to the business piece of this, we read some reports about what was discussed. Whenever you see the president go out and play golf with people, famously he's played golf with John Boehner in the past, and what sort of deals are they going to strike? One thought is, if he's going to go out with about a group of House Democrats, is what do you think about this Iran deal? I mean, you guys are going to have to eyeball this and take a look at it. So did you talk about Iran at all?
We did not.
Yeah.
And I really I know in this world of House of Cards, view of Congress, that people think, everything's transactional and nothing is innocent. But I will tell you, it was a very normal interaction. I'd never played Andrews, so it was a dog leg left, dog leg right. Is the pin up? Is the pin back? Where's the wind? And we talked about family. He had just come back from New York City, where he and his daughters went out to see that new musical, hip hop musical, Hamilton, which he gave high, you know, positive reviews to. And, you know, again, it was just a very normal sort of. I mentioned the fact that the First Lady's coming up to Groton for the christening of the USS Illinois in October, which we're very excited about. But and at the end, you know, when we were saying goodbye, you know, he really actually just said, you know what, he mentioned it. You noticed I didn't bring this up. I didn't want to. I didn't want this to be sort of, that brought into what really was just a promise that he made to Ed over a year ago. But this is the issue of the day this week. I'm getting on a plane in a few minutes, as you and I discussed, and Secretary Kerry's coming over to do a classified bipartisan briefing tomorrow along with Secretary Moniz. And I'm still studying this agreement. I got my dog-eared copy here with me right now, which we've been going over. Armed Services Committee, which I serve on, as you know, we've been talking about this issue for months now. And it's a lot to sort of absorb. But again, a round of golf was not the place to do it.
Well, let's actually hear from Secretary Kerry. He was on NPR's Morning Edition giving an answer to a what-if question. What if Congress actually rejects this Iran nuclear deal?
If the United States Congress says no, this deal isn't going forward, and they actually got enough votes to kill the deal, there's no deal. If there's no deal, there are no sanctions, there are no inspections, and Iran will say, aha, you see, the Ayatollah will say, I told you can't trust the West. I told you can't negotiate with these guys. They will lie to you. They will cheat you. And here they are. They led us down the path, and the Congress walked away. They have 535 secretaries of state. There's nobody to negotiate with. And our European allies will walk away saying, well, we tried our best. Now we trust Iran, and we're going to go do something. And they'll cut their own deal. We're finished. I'm telling you, the U.S. will have lost all credibility. And if we then decided to use military, do you believe the United Nations will be with us? Do you think our European colleagues will support us? Not in your life.
Again, that's Secretary of State John Kerry speaking very forcefully about what he thinks Congress should do around this Iran nuclear deal. We're talking with Connecticut's 2nd Congressional Representative Joe Courtney today on the program. So first of all, what's your reaction to John Kerry there?
Well, my reaction initially is that there's an overarching point, which I agree with, which is that for the critics that have obviously descended on this deal in record time, I mean, there is a burden of proof that they have to sustain about, you know, what is, what happens next if the deal is rejected. And Dennis Ross, who, again, in my opinion, is one of the real solid, respected voices in Washington, worked under President Bush Sr., Bill Clinton, and President Obama for a short period of time, and has been very skeptical of this process and this deal. But he wrote what I think was an outstanding editorial in the Washington Post. Actually, the Manchester Journal Enquirer reprinted it yesterday, where he made that point. Again, he laid out the issues that he thinks are of concern in this proposed deal. But also at the end said, you know, the opponents also have a burden. And that sometimes gets lost in some of the critics' comments, which is that they, Senator Lieberman had a piece in the Hartford Courant. Again, I worked with him a lot when he was there in Washington while I was there on defense issues that affect Connecticut. But the notion that you can just start over again, which was sort of the gist of his piece, you know, reject it and let's start all over. This coalition is not a monolith. The six countries that it consists of, particularly Russia and China, I do think they're done. You know, this agreement is either going to happen or they're just going to go off in their own direction in terms of resuming economic relations with Iran. And so, you know, that's where I think Secretary Kerry has a point. On the other hand, I would say this. The president signed the bill that allowed for congressional review of this agreement. And frankly, Secretary Kerry has a burden also in terms of sort of walking through a lot of questions, which, again, like Dennis Ross and others have raised, that people need answers to. They need to understand this agreement. Where there's a healthy process here for a democracy.
Well, you say you're going to sit down with the Secretary. So what do you ask him? What are your questions specifically?
I mean, you know, look, if this deal is not based on trust, Iran is a bad actor, and they still are to this minute as we're sitting here. In many respects, these agreements really turn on the question of the legitimacy and integrity of the inspection process. You know, the good news that came out when the deal was released, which is that a lot of the fears that were expressed about restricted areas in Iran to the IAEA inspectors really were set aside. In other words, there was concern that military installations in Iran would be off limits to IAEA inspectors. That was totally unacceptable. You know, you're not going to have a credible inspection regime if there's places that you can't go to, particularly military places. So that's the good news. I mean, the question and concern that people have is that Iran still has the opportunity to object to requests for inspections. There is a process which, again, the administration would argue is very truncated in terms of trying to resolve a dispute. But, you know, looking at the fine print, it looks like it's about a 24-day process, you know, in terms of the maximum time period. You know, I want to hear from particularly Secretary Moniz, you know, who's really kind of the nuclear physicist expert, about whether or not, you know, that really is too long in terms of giving, you know, the other side an opportunity to remove items where there's suspicions that activity is going on. So, I mean, that's a big one for me. I visited military installations in the U.S. where we have nuclear stockpiles as part of my Armed Services Committee. Russian inspectors and IAEA inspectors visit those sites in the U.S. I mean, I actually sat in a room with a nuclear warhead that's about – could fit on this table. Kind of amazing things to sort of, you know, be in the presence of. But they did sort of walk through the process that inspectors are allowed to go to count, you know, to measure And you know, that's what's kept, you know, START Treaty and the new START Treaty, you know, working incredible. And that's really where I think my biggest sort of focus is. I mean, there are other questions in terms of the removal of the core of the AROC reactor, in terms of just making sure that, you know, plutonium is not going to be at all feasible or possible, you know, more than just 10 years, but even a longer time period. And also, you know, just sort of what's the, you know, what's the procedure, what's the snapback for sanctions if Iran actually does violate the terms of the agreement?
Well, and I think that piece of the sanctions piece, and if you have questions, by the way, for Joe Courtney, who represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District, call us at 860-275-7266, specifically around the Iran nuclear deal. The president addressed this this week in his press conference as he was speaking about this and trying to silence some of the critics who say, you know, this deal really is about this nuclear program, and it's really not about all the other things. It's not about Iran as a state sponsor of terrorism. It's not about what they might use their newfound wealth that is coming from the lifting of these sanctions for. But how concerned are you about that piece of it, that it, indeed maybe we set back Iran's nuclear capability 10 years, but we increase Iran's capability to do something else nefarious within that part of the world exponentially because we've lifted sanctions that have been in some ways shown to be crippling?
It's a big concern. As I said, I mean, this nation is a supporter of horrible bad actors in the Middle East, Hezbollah, you know, the Houthis in Yemen. And again, I think that's sort of a question that I think needs to be posed, you know, and particularly so almost from a military standpoint, sort of what is going to be the sort of coalition's sort of system in terms of enforcing stopping, you know, some of that activity. I mean, in recent months, just to give you an example, there was and you may recall there were news reports that Iran was sending shipments by sea to Yemen to arm the Houthi rebels. The USS Theodore Roosevelt, you know, which was stationed out in that part of the world because a lot of the airstrikes against ISIS have been being flown from that aircraft carrier. They steamed over to the coast of Yemen and blocked those shipments from going into play. And so, I mean, you know, this is not going to be if this agreement goes through, it's not the end of, you know, the Fifth Fleet's mission in the Middle East. I visited over there in Bahrain, and you know, they patrol the Straits of Hormuz. I mean, there again are military forces, the Quds Force, particularly in Iran, who you know, there's questions sometimes almost about what the civilian control over them is because they are so you know, radicalized and militant. So, I mean, we're that's a part of the world where we're still going to have our hands full. Again, I think the notion of compartmentalization and particularly in terms of nuclear weapons, is a valid one. I mean, it certainly was part of America's strategic policies during the era of the Soviet Union, and it was a bipartisan one. And you know, nuclear weapons are in a special category. And so I think that, you know, on the one hand, you know, people should not sort of lump everything together in terms of expectations. But on the other hand, you know, and at the same time, I mean, I think that there has to be a recognition that if there's a denuclearized Iran that, you know, is really credible, that's a good thing for the world.
We're talking with Congressman Joe Courtney. When we come back, we're going to talk more about this Iran deal and more about international politics. Of course, Joe Courtney serves on the House Armed Services Committee. If you have questions for us, 860-275-7266. You can always find us online. It's WNPR.org/where we live or on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today, our guest in studio is Joe Courtney, who represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District. The congressman is good enough to talk with us here in our studio before he heads down to Washington to do more business for the state. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266, and we're going to get to some of your phone calls in just a moment. It was recently announced that the Navy would establish a new underseas warfighting development center at the U.S. Naval Submarine Base, New London. Can you explain, Congressman, what this is and how it impacts what we might see here in the region?
Sure. It's actually, I think, a very exciting development for the sub-base, which, as you know, has had sort of near-death experiences in two BRAC rounds, one in the 90s and one in 2005. And, you know, the base actually, over the last 8 years has been really, I think, making solid progress in terms of modernizing its facilities, you know, a lot of new construction. The state of Connecticut actually has participated in some of that in terms of infrastructure improvements, which is actually quite unique and something that the state can really point to with pride. But again, the CNO of the Navy, John Greenert, announced, as you mentioned, that now Groton is going to be designated as the undersea warfighting center for the U.S. Navy entirely. We are going to have a rear admiral, Admiral Trussell, taking over within a matter of weeks. We had flag officers, admirals at the sub base in up until about 2 or 3 years ago. Again, Secretary Gates had done sort of a shakeup to consolidate a lot of commands, and so we actually have not had an admiral at the base there. That is now going to change with this new flag officer. But even more important is the function that this means, which is that undersea warfighting in San Diego and Norfolk will report to Groton, Connecticut, and there's obviously going to be some increase in terms of personnel on the base as a result of that. But what it really means, in my opinion, and I think most observers, is that the military value of the base goes up when you've got a national command center that's there. I mean, we still have 15 subs tied up there, and it's a very busy place. And frankly, I think with events that are happening in Europe, in Northern Europe, with the recapitalization of the Russian Navy, Groton's importance in terms of where it actually is located has, you know, been heightened, unfortunately, in some respects because of events that are external events that are happening. But again, having this command center with a rear admiral assigned there, again, I think is just a really emphatic statement about the enduring value of this base.
Since you actually brought up infrastructure, I'm going to ask two infrastructure questions surrounding that region very quickly. One comes from Fred Carstensen, who you know. He just emailed us. He's a professor of finance and economics at UConn. He says, yesterday with fanfare, CURE announced that the Groton incubator would have 1G connectivity. Why, given that Connecticut has invested millions in a world-class 100G network that is in the ground and to which Groton could easily be connected, are we failing to use it? And in doing so, condemning ourselves to vastly inferior IT connectivity. What do you know about this?
Well, again, the CURE folks have been in to see us. And again, this is sort of a state initiative. The reuse of buildings, the Pfizer buildings that are not occupied with the shakeup that occurred about 3 or 4 years ago is a good thing. And having an incubator space, again, that's focused on bioscience is but as Fred points out, I mean, you know, having the highest level of access to internet and you know, fast transmission of information is the name of the game in terms of, you know, companies that want to locate here. you know, across the river, when Electric Boat bought the Pfizer building today, if you walked in there, it's a Google-like environment. There are over 3,000 engineers and designers that are working there. About 15% of the graduating class of the School of Engineering at UConn were hired up this spring. There's about 50 or 60 interns from the School of Engineering that are working there. And if you look at the Ohio Replacement Program, that kind of work is going to be this is not a one-year blip. This is a 30-year life cycle costs, life cycle span for the Ohio program, and all of that design work, none of it's being shared with Virginia, is taking place in Groton. But again, to the extent that the state wants to, you know, make this environment more conducive to you know, what incubators are all about, which is attracting new startups and you know, creating that sort of synergistic center of excellence, that's critical.
You know, I actually have another infrastructure question. I'll come back to that in a moment, though, because I want to get a call from Jim in Springfield, Massachusetts. Of course, you can join us at 860-275-7266. Hello, Jim. You're on with Congressman Courtney.
Thank you. Congressman, I know you have been gathering signatures to try to repeal the so-called Cadillac tax as part of the Affordable Care Act, and I'm wondering whether that's gathering steam or what exactly the status of that effort is.
Sure. Thanks, Jim. So, yes, you're right. Under the Affordable Care Act, there was a provision that the Senate added at the sort of late stages of the process called the Cadillac tax by some. It's actually an excise tax on health plans above certain thresholds. The Cadillac term is a misnomer because it sort of suggests that it's only, you know, the top 1% health plans that are affected by it. But, you know, you talk to actuaries across the board, they will tell you that, in fact, Ford Focus drivers are going to be, you know, swept up by this tax. It goes into effect by law in 2018. But you talk to HR folks in non-union employment situations, insurance agents, but, you know, certainly municipalities and states and counties who are negotiating long-term contracts. 2018 is now in terms of trying to respond to this. And really, the only way you can comply with this tax is really to just drastically increase people's deductibles and out-of-pockets, because it sweeps up in its calculation the employee's share of the value of their health plan, as well as other components of their health care, such as wellness clinics and prevention, which is, you know, totally at odds, I think, with the purpose of the ACA. At the time, I actually organized 192 House members in opposition to this. As a result of that, we pushed back the date of implementation from 2013 to 2018. In terms of what's happening now, HR 2050, which I introduced back in May, we're up to 122 co-sponsors. It is bipartisan. We have about 50 organizations of, you know, every stripe that have endorsed this legislation, employer groups, including the U.S. Chamber, retail merchants, as well as, you know, labor unions. And it's picking up speed because, frankly, it's not because Joe Courtney's, you know, the greatest organizer, arm twister. It's because, frankly, it's got a life of its own as people begin to become sort of aware and try and calculate how you comply with it. And so, I, you know, to me, it's like that, you know, DOC formula that was in the Medicare law that we got rid of a few months ago, the SGR. You know, it's one of these sort of unworkable provisions that, in my opinion, is going to force change, because it's just it lands on people in a very arbitrary, unfair way. If you talk to actuaries, premiums are calculated based on risk, and risk is based more on how old you are, your gender. So women, frankly, when they calculate employee health plans, are frankly treated as a higher cost. And also the region of the country that you live in, much more so than benefit design. And that's really the flaw in this that I frankly thought, you know, the whole thing shouldn't have been included initially. And in 5 years later, it doesn't look any better.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Bouncing around a bit, we were talking a moment ago about some infrastructure issues in the Groton-New London area. We just reported this week on a possibility, or at least conversation, about expansion around the Groton-New London Airport. This is something that would connect your part of the world to the rest of the world much more readily, especially around this new naval center, around the sub-base. What can you tell us about that and what that would mean for the region?
So one thing that I think the state has done really well is that they created a new sort of airport authority governance structure that, you know, I think has really consolidated and, you know, looking at this in terms of an economic development tool. Kevin Dillon is the director of it, and he's been very active in terms of engaging at both the local and federal level. And the Groton Airfield, which is there today, but is, you know, has a relatively limited runway, doesn't have much in the way of terminal infrastructure. You know, given the fact that, as you point out, there's a naval institution there that has a lot of traffic, you know, from out of state that comes in there. Electric Boat, which is roughly between Quonset Point and Groton, is at about 9,000 employees. And the projections, which Jeff Geiger, the CEO, is looking at, is probably it's going to grow to about 13,000 with the Virginia-class contract and the Ohio replacement contract. Again, this is, you know, a beehive of activity in terms of suppliers, government officials coming in and out. And frankly, I just think there's a lot of other good sort of things that are starting to really sprout up in southeastern Connecticut. So the Groton Airport, I think, is a beautiful way to enhance that growth. And there was a meeting that the authority had, again, with a lot of the large end users to sort of, you know, feel people out in terms of their appetite for it, but also, you know, what needs to be done. I mean, the runway, I think, needs to be extended or certainly modified to accommodate, you know, bigger planes and more traffic. And again, if that were to click in, I mean, in terms of tourism, which, you know, everything from Mystic Seaport to the casinos.
We've got these big casinos down there. People,
the,
you know, want to come in.
Coast Guard Museum, where, I mean, it is really people are now moving forward in a very real, tangible way. I'm a very strong supporter that this asset, which has been kind of way underutilized right now, is going to be a real you know, shot in the arm for the region.
And not just because, you know, you've got to go to D.C. twice a week and you've got to drive an hour and a half to Bradley.
Well, in Vernon, I'm sort of trapped.
That's
either
right.
Way,
I know. So, exactly. You're kind of in between.
Yeah.
This isn't in your district, but I think it's really important to defense contracting in the state. It was announced that Lockheed Martin will purchase Sikorsky for $9 billion. The Defense Department does have to approve the bill. What impact do you think this has on Connecticut's defense industry? Not a whole lot of word right now on what it's going to mean for jobs in Connecticut, but what's your overall take on this deal?
Well, the good news is that Lockheed and Sikorsky don't do the same thing right now in terms of helicopters, frames, which is what, you know, they, you know, primarily do down at the Sikorsky plant. And I talked to Bob LaDuke, who's the acting CEO at Sikorsky. And he actually was very bullish on this in terms of its state impact. And we've actually had a contact yesterday from Lockheed representatives who also said that they, you know, view what's happening down there in Stratford as, you know, something they don't want to, you know, disturb or upset. Again, it's one of these amazing workshops, if people ever have the chance to visit, where, you're really seeing, you know, more craftsmen, artisan type of work as opposed to assembly line work. And that's just not something you can kind of recreate in another location overnight. I mean, obviously, Sikorsky goes back to the origins of helicopters. So it brings a lot to the table. And by all indications, you know, Lockheed, you know, really sees that as something that's, you know, that will complement what they have and not something that they want to swallow up and move around. So, I mean, at this point, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your role and the role of the other members in armed services as you consider what the United States needs to do to protect itself around the world, but then also some of the interests that you have back home as far as the jobs it takes to create this? And this is a conversation you and I have had in the past, but you mentioned this earlier. You know, right now we're facing an incredibly aggressive Russia that may mean in the near future we're extending our submarine capabilities more than we thought maybe we would. We see other types of terrorism around the world that might suggest different types of weapon systems are what we might want to build. So I'm just wondering if you can talk about what the day-to-day conversation is amongst other members of that committee around those two issues, what the United States needs to defend itself around the world, and then what you and all the other folks who serve, because, I mean, frankly, you all serve because there's parochial interests there,
right,
on keeping jobs in the places where you have jobs right now.
So I'm in my ninth year now, and I'm now ranking member on Sea Power and Projection Forces, which means that, you know, I'm sort of getting deeper and deeper into some of these issues. Yesterday, actually, I was at the Naval War College down in Rhode Island, where a lot of the same questions that you just asked were being posed in the 5 hours that I visited with some of the faculty. And, you know, some of the guys who this is all they do is think about this sort of thing. And, clearly, we represent a district, and that's your job, is to, you know, push their priorities as much as possible. When I first came to Congress, and the submarine program was kind of limping along at one a year, and there was no new design work being done for any new class of submarines, frankly, it was more of an uphill battle than it is today. And you know, partly because, you know, we've succeeded to some degree in terms of getting the two a year in the largest shipbuilding contract in American history with the Block 4 deal that was signed last year by the Navy. But what I will say is this, is that, you know, the world has changed as well. As you point out, you know, you've got, a large nation. I want to call them necessarily a superpower at this point, but Russia is clearly aggressively recapitalizing their Navy, and they are definitely being very aggressive in the neighborhood up there. And when General Dempsey was kind of giving his farewell testimony before the House Armed Services Committee and was asked to rank, where he thinks the biggest sort of external threats to the U.S. is, and the new incoming chairman, General Dunford from the Marines, they actually both put Russia at the absolute top of the list, above ISIS, above China. And there's just no question that, you know, the Russian Navy, more than any other Navy in the world, has both the capacity and the capability of having an undersea fleet. So, you know, the argument to make in terms of Electric Boat's position in the pecking order is a lot different. And frankly, it's a lot more accepted. We had a vote in the House on the question of the Ohio replacement program, which I co-managed the amendment on the floor. We got 321 votes. It was 75% of the House Republican caucus and 75% of the Democratic caucus on our prevailing side. So it's a different sort of environment. There are other programs, as you point out, in Connecticut that, helicopters are going to be more leveled off. And, I mean, frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why UTC is spinning it off, is that there's going to be a lot of work to do, a lot of Blackhawks. But it's not like it was in the 2000s when you had a land war in the Middle East and the demand and the production went up, spiked up. It's not going to be like that in the near future.
And I think we can all be thankful for that. Fewer
right.
land wars is probably a good thing.
Yes.
Connected to this, and I'm sure that you get this as well, you know, when you talk to people about the work that you do on armed services. You know, last week Politico reported on campaign contributions from defense contractors to members of the Armed Services Committee. The report says that you received, for instance, $632,000 from defense contractors. How do you comment on reports like this? Because clearly, people who are running every 2 years are receiving campaign contributions from lots of different organizations. And clearly, if you sit on armed services, people from defense contractors are going to want to give money to you. But when people say, well, is there some sort of a conflict of interest here for you or anybody else who is voting on these things? How do you answer?
Well, number one, what I would say is that if you really drill down deeper, I mean, this is over a fairly, long period of time, because
sure.
I'm in year nine, as we mentioned earlier. I frankly have no hesitation in terms of answering these questions, because, I mean, I can really point to the fact that, this is bread and butter issues. This is a big piece of Connecticut's economy, particularly Eastern Connecticut's economy. And and the people who contribute to their political committee are the, folks who contribute to Connecticut every day. So, people can judge that and determine that any way that they want. I will say this, though. I mean, we're living in a time where the defense budget, when I came into office, was growing at double-digit leaps in the sort of post-9/11 era. We hit a tipping point in terms of the base budget of the Defense Department, where actually it leveled and then it's actually down a little bit. And, some would argue that it's down too much. But the point is that, whether it's the Virginia-class program, whether it's the F-35 engine work in East Hartford, whether it's at least keeping, a level plateau in terms of helicopter acquisition, I mean, the fact is Connecticut's in, I think, at the center of really where the national priorities have been identified, with every neutral, non-parochial, quadrennial defense review. Secretary Gates did his national security review. Again, the undersea fleet is at the absolute top of the list because, it's still the one area where the U.S. has complete domination. The Chinese Navy is scrambling to sort of catch up, and they're projecting more in the sort of first chain of islands, you know, from Japan and Philippines down there. But, there's just no question that our submarine fleet is the one sort of queen on the chessboard that they really can't sort of block or get in the way of.
Joe Courtney represents the 2nd Congressional District in Connecticut, and he joins us today on the program. If you want to call us with a question, 860-275-7266. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, local races across the state have caught our eye, from the crowded field running for mayor in Hartford to the Bridgeport race, which pits the incumbent versus a former mayor who went to jail for corruption. In the Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable, we'll check in on those races and other news from around the state. Hope you can join us tomorrow. Today on the show, Joe Courtney is here. He represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District. We're taking your calls at 860-275-7266. Peter from Stamford is good enough to call in. Hi there, Peter. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Yes, thank you. Just getting back to thank you, Mr. Courtney, for coming on. But I know you're the congressman from the 2nd District, but there was a lot of talk about the bridges in the state under dire need of repair all over, not only just in the New London area, but I'm wondering, how does that work as far as prioritizing what bridges to be fixed first? And are we actually safe going on 95 through a few cities like Bridgeport or Waterbury? I know there's work on the mix, what's that called, the Mixmaster, where
yes.
Every time I go over it, I see, you know, it's rusty there, you know, and I know there's also the Aetna Viaduct or something in Hartford.
Right,
the one that runs.
Are we safe driving on the interstates in the state of Connecticut?
Well, and Peter, thank you, first of all. It's a great question. I'll expand on that. We talk about this an awful lot, and we talk about it as a state-level priority with the governor and with folks from the DOT. And the governor has seen this as a big issue, and he's put forward a massive plan, but any plan as big as rebuilding bridges and infrastructure of highways in a state like Connecticut is going to require a lot of money and time from the federal government. And we get this kind of mixed message, which is our infrastructure is not just going to fail, but it is failing now. And it's literally behind on so many things. And we hear it from so many levels of politicians, from the president to the governor, et cetera, that it makes Peter wonder, I mean, is it actually safe now? So I think there's a couple different questions here. What's the short-term plan from the federal government to make sure that our infrastructure is safe? And then what's the long-term plan to make it more the infrastructure we want?
So let me start with the latter part. I mean, the long-term plan is that if we had a normal surface transportation bill, which we've had going back to Dwight Eisenhower, which is a 5-year authorization with more robust financing, the fact is that there's infinite almost amount of work out there that needs to be done. And obviously, fix it first, which has been the sort of motto of the State Department of Transportation in terms of a public safety standpoint, as Peter, asked about, is job one. And there's just no question that, the department, which does, I think, try its hardest to sort of inventory what's out there right now as far as the most acute in need of repair. We've got some places that are big concern. I mean, the Gold Star Bridge, which is nothing to sneeze at either, which connects Groton and New London, is, the governor's held press conferences there, which is not a new bridge. It needs an upgrade. And, so the long-term issue is that, for us to keep limping along at the authorized level, which was really when the last surface transportation bill was passed in 2008, I believe, it was before my time. So it was, 2007 or 2008. So I came in 06. Excuse me.
That's been so long ago. Yeah.
But, we've done these little patches. In fact, the House just voted on a 5-month patch a couple of days ago. Larson and I and Rosa, we were watching it on the board and just saying, I can't do this anymore because you can't even do paving. you know, with a 5-month window. Now, this morning's press, actually, Mitch McConnell is talking about unveiling with Barbara Boxer. Talk about two unlikely,
absolutely,
political allies, but a longer term, like a 3 or 4 year, again, which. It'd be nice if we could just go back to the old-fashioned way. But nonetheless, I mean, that's something that they're going to release later today. And I am all ears and eyes because that, you know, when we get that done, that provides the state of Connecticut, which requires, you know, heavy federal match to do a lot of these large projects, the ability to have a horizon and actually plan to deal with all the bridges that Peter asked about. But again, the list is long. You know, the same is true with Amtrak. The Old Saybrook Bridge, which crosses the Connecticut River, if you sail past those pilings, if you're ever out there with friends, it is kind of disturbing.
There's another Amtrak bridge, another rail bridge further down in the southwest corner of the state that keeps getting stuck open, and it shuts down the Northeast corridor to transit. And so it's not just a Connecticut problem. It's not just a Northeast problem.
What happened in Philadelphia was just criminal in terms of, that was a preventable accident. And that equipment exists that would have actually slowed that train down without human intervention. And its budget got cut a few days afterwards. I'm sure you remember the press stories about that.
It gets to this. So you mentioned Mitch McConnell and Barbara Boxer, unlikely allies trying to maybe solve a little piece over the course of a couple of years, an infrastructure problem. So, I mean, you're there every day, and we have this almost cartoonish notion of what Congress is like, in which people hate each other and they don't talk to each other, and nobody ever wants to get anything done, and it's all about politics and getting reelected again in a couple of years. I mean, around issues like that, is there the possibility of some coming together, of people actually saying, we can't have a train crash in Philadelphia because we don't have stuff that easily is preventable, that's easily put on these tracks? I mean, does that actually move people, or doesn't it work that way in Washington?
Well, as you may have seen in this morning's news, I mean, John Larson actually had the Republican chairman of the Transportation Committee in town yesterday, Bill Schuster, who, I think all of us, know when you talk to him that, he is somebody who is in favor of a very robust strong package. His dad preceded him, and that was his signature issue as well.
It absolutely was.
And the good news is there is some overlap in terms of the two sides about financing a large boost. As I think you've heard, the repatriation of sort of offshore corporate profits that could be brought back to the country with a change in the corporate tax rate and a sort of a discounted payment that corporations could bring back. I mean, we're talking big bucks here in terms of having a deal like that. So that was in the Obama budget, and it's also something Paul Ryan has called for. It does not sound like that's part of the Mitch McConnell, Barbara Boxer package that's coming out later today. So what I would say to you is that, it's not like all, hope is lost. the challenge that, raising the gas tax, which is obviously another option that gets a lot of discussion, is that as cars become more fuel efficient, and that's a good thing, and people are actually driving a little bit less, it's not the most reliable revenue source that's out there. So so other ideas are being put on the table, and again, the public gets it, and so. And by the way, in two positive developments this Congress: HR 2, where we did the Medicare doc fix, stabilized the Medicare system. Total bipartisan negotiation that took place, believe it or not, between Nancy Pelosi and John Boehner. Huge bipartisan vote to get that passed. We also just passed the 21st Century Cures Act, which is a fully paid-for infusion of about $10 billion into NIH, the National Institute of Health, cancer research, Alzheimer's research. I actually got my provision in there on Lyme disease.
I wanted to ask you about that. Could you just quickly say so? Because we're running a long time.
Sure.
I'd like to hear just a moment on that.
Well, so Chris Gibson, Republican from New York, and I had a bill to basically put Lyme disease into the NIH's inventory of conditions and diseases that they need to study. As many of your listeners know, there's lots of different conflicted beliefs out there about the way, whether it exists even as an illness, how it's diagnosed, what are appropriate treatments and therapies. This is about getting this within the NIH's radar scope and coming up with a very strict timeline to report back, what I think is really the common scientifically accepted analysis of you know, how to diagnose this, how to treat it. That's sort of what insurance companies and Medicare and other, you know, payers of healthcare adopt. And we're really pleased and excited that got in there. I mean, Connecticut is still ground zero. We're a heavily wooded state and lots of ticks, and but it's spreading around the country. And frankly, it was a pretty easy sell once we. There was a couple folks that were opposed to it, but we got it done. It's in the bill.
It's another one of those things where it just seems shocking that the long-term implications of it, just like the long-term implications of a bad infrastructure, are not really known, and we haven't been able to really study it. And this is, I think, it's a step forward because it's certainly something we've talked about before. Just a quick lightning round with a couple minutes left. I want to go through some things. The House and Senate are revisiting the No Child Left Behind Act. Want to negotiate some sort of a final bill. Where does this stand, and what do you want to see out of this as we reauthorize No Child Left Behind or not, or change it?
Well, I think the Senate bill is far preferable to the House bill. The House bill, and you know, was a hyper-partisan effort passed on a straight party line vote. Actually, a number of Republicans voted no. The Senate bill was very bipartisan, and it gave, I think, more flexibility in terms of some of the, you know, persistent complaints about overtesting and No Child Left Behind. It's going to still have some accountability, but not the annual, you know, teach to the test, high stakes system that I think really has just been the bane of I think student proficiency. So I mean, I give great credit to Senator Alexander and Senator Murray in terms of putting that together. There's also strong investment in the Senate bill in STEM education, which, again, you talk to employer groups out there. It is almost a crisis in terms of trying to get young people engaged in, the hard sciences. You know, the income potential is three times non-STEM. The job openings and demand that's out there is very strong. So anyway, and none of that was in the House bill. I mean, it was this very ideological provision freezing Title I at 2012 levels, even though there's going to be 3 million more kids going to school in America, over the next.
That's a long time ago,
I'm kind of an optimist about the fact that once we get into conference that, the Senate provisions are going to, a lot of them are going to prevail.
President Obama is addressing a VFW convention in Pittsburgh. He's expected to discuss some ongoing issues facing vets, like health care, predatory loans to veterans. I mean, what do you see as something we've been talking in the press all this week about veterans and veterans affairs, in part because of a presidential candidate who I won't mention talking a lot about it. But the fact of the matter is that we probably do need to talk about what we're doing for our veterans. We just have a minute left. I mean, what do you see as the big priorities right now?
Well, if you look at the complaints that we get in our office, and as you know, we've got probably the highest concentration out there in eastern Connecticut. It's just that, we need to get more clinical staff on the ground, whether it's in Newington, at the clinics in New London, Willimantic, or West Haven. Again, because the volume is really not spiked up the way it has in Sunbelt states, comparatively speaking, we're not as bad in terms of weights. But it's still, the specialty areas, we've got to find ways to attract, the dermatologists, specialty nurses. We've frankly got to use a lot more primary care nurse practitioners, PAs in the system, which, it hasn't totally caught up in the VA in terms of that kind of new model of healthcare delivery. Again, our Veterans Advisory Councils in Norwich and Enfield, I mean, these folks are still very loyal to the VA system. They like to have therapists and doctors who understand military service, and that's something that we want to preserve, but access is at the end of the day the number one issue in terms of making sure people are getting their appointments in a timely fashion, and it's more clinical staff.
Joe Courtney represents Connecticut's 2nd Congressional District. He holds about a 12 handicap, from what I understand. He joined us today in the program. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, and safe travels down to D.C.
Thanks, John.
Of course, you can always continue our conversation at wnpr.org/where we live. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.